Welcome back to another episode of The Occasionalist. Matt Pagel here once again, holding down the fort solo as we continue on with our current events week. Yesterday I talked a little bit about sports gambling and gave you some background info on gambling in the United States and how it kind of evolved. But, you know, I really got into the Shohei Ohtani situation yesterday, which was an interesting sort of change of pace for normally how we do this show. So that was it was actually a lot of fun to do that, especially getting into the background history of everything. And today we're going to have our most extensive sort of history lesson. So I do want to get right into this, because today we are talking about Vladimir Putin. Have you heard of him? I think you have. We're going to be talking about Vladimir Putin, but again, we want to give you a quick history lesson about Russia and kind of a double history lesson here about 20th century Russia and also Vladimir's time in the KGB. The early history of Vladimir Putin before his entrance into Russian politics in the 1990s. Before we get into our current topic, which of course we're going to wrap up with a current topic, the Crocus City Hall terror attack in Moscow. So that's how we're going to kick off this episode. So let's get into it. Let's get into our little Russian history lesson here. Okay, so I think a good place to start here is to go all the way back to the formation of what would become modern Russia. Going all the way back to the early 20th century, the Bolshevik Revolution, and then kind of work our way forward from there. Don't worry, we're not going to get into every single important political figure from essentially 1917 onward, but we are going to mention a few important ones here. But the head of the Russian state prior to 1917 was the head of the state and government. It was the czars, right? Like you probably have heard that term, and you may even know some of the more famous czars in Russian history. I'll just kind of focus here on the last czar of the Russian Empire, Tsar Nicholas II. Again, this is probably one of the more famous tales of Russian history, so much so that it really has permeated pop culture for quite a long time. But Tsar Nicholas II was the last Tsar of the Russian Empire, and his death was his death and his family's death was, you know, marked the end of the Russian Empire, marked the end of the Romanov dynasty. You're probably fairly familiar with that, with the Romanov name. Anastasia Romanoff being the most famous name to come out of this. The entire family was, after abdicating the throne and trying to escape, the entire family was eventually tracked down and killed, beaten to death by Bolsheviks. And Anastasia Romanoff's name kind of really carried on, because I believe it was in 1920 or 1921, there was a woman who claimed to have been Anastasia, that she survived that attack on her family. In fact, that tale carried on for quite a long time, I believe into the 80s or the 90s, when there was enough DNA technology to kind of prove that tale false. But she wasn't the only one. There are other people throughout this time period that would claim to be, be it Anastasia or some other surviving Romanov. There were people claiming to be surviving descendants of the Romanovs. But in particular, Anastasia Romanov's story really fueled intrigue into the Romanovs and the last, the last Russian czar and the last Russian and the Romanov dynasty as the last dynasty of the Russian Empire. Getting Romanov and Russian confused there. But her story is like the last, the last czar and the last family of the Russian Empire, really fueled pop culture for quite a long time. Interest in this story in pop culture, I should say, for quite a long time. I believe there's a Disney movie, an older Disney movie, just called Anastasia, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, you also get one of the more famous and notorious figures in Russian history also come out of this period as the advisor to Tsar Nicholas and the Tsarina. I can't remember Tsar Nicholas's wife's Alexandra, maybe. Should have probably looked that up before I put this down. But Rasputin was essentially the advisor to both Tsar Nicholas, the Tsarina, and the family. And he was a a mystic. Really kind of the probably one of the last time periods in modern human history that you really could still sort of be a still sort of cast yourself as essentially a wizard. And fool people, you know, fool people who still were, you know, a lot of these people were, you know, were born before the turn of the 20th century. So, you know, someone being mystical and magical, not too, it's not like we're not far away from sort of still a lot of, you know, having a lot of people still believe in that kind of stuff. So Rasputin, this very notorious figure in Russian history and pop culture, you know, probably more, even more famous than the Romanovs themselves, outside of Russia in terms of his kind of relevance in pop culture. Again, he's been in all sorts of movies. The name has been characterized in all sorts of movies and stuff. So Rasputin also comes out of this time period. Then we move on to the modern Russian presidents, and this kind of covers the time period from 1992 to 1991. During this time period, they're obviously not called presidents. This is the general, what they would have been called with the general secretary of the Communist Party. And this is where, if you're a history buff, or even not a history buff, but certainly if you're a history buff, this is where a lot of the classic names in Russian history come from. You're Joseph Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, Leonid Brezhnev, Mikhail Gorbachev as the last general secretary of the Communist Party. That's the time period of when you really think about communist Russia and you really think about Russia's importance on the world map, it really is this time period from the 1920s all the way through 1991. And that's an important time period there because this then leads to the constitutional crisis of 1993. And a complete rewriting of the rewriting of the Constitution, reorganization of the Russian government, the Russian economy, you know, a lot of turnover in a very short period of time from between 1991 and 1993, which eventually leads to the semi-presidential system of today. These are not true presidents. When we do talk about the Russian presidents from 1991 on, these are not true presidents. They kind of have like a split sort of system where they're not the head of state, but they're the head of government and the head of the military. And I don't want to get into those details. You can look that up. But anyway, the constitutional crisis of 1993 leads to this very, very big turnover. And then we have our first true Russian president, which is actually kind of hard to believe that our first Russian president doesn't take office until 1991, and it's Boris Yeltsin, who holds the office from 1991 through 1999. And then in 2000, Vladimir Putin gets his first crack at being the Russian president from 2000 to 2008. He is then followed by Dmitry Medvedev from 2008 to 2012, and then in 2012 to the present day, and you know, possibly forever moving forward, Vladimir Putin is president again. So Vladimir Putin is our second and fourth Russian president, along there with Boris Yeltsin and Dmitry Medvedev. As I just mentioned, Medvedev in 2020 was actually appointed prime minister. And I think he was appointed prime minister prior to that. But as prime minister in 2020, Medvedev and the rest of the entire Russian government resigned. And this is when people probably remember this. This is when Putin made sweeping constitutional changes because there was literally no one in any government position that could have opposed him, or there essentially was no one to act as a safety or a double check on what he was actually doing. So Putin is essentially free to make these sweeping constitutional changes, and he effectively makes himself president for life. And Medvedev is rewarded with some other position, because I think prime minister still exists, but I think Medvedev is given a different role, kind of to make it seem like it's more legit or something. I don't know, but Medvedev is no longer prime minister, essentially. So that is the brief history. I think this is fairly brief, but that is the brief history of the head of the Russian state from the formation of what would become modern Russia in the early 20th century all the way up to now Vladimir Putin, essentially claiming the Kremlin for himself for the foreseeable future. He's 71 years old, so who knows how much longer he has left, but however much longer he has left to live, he will be the Russian president. So let's get into the second part of our history lesson, and this is Vladimir Putin and the KGB. So we're actually going to start a little bit before that, because I do find this part very, very interesting. There's two parts of this that just kind of blow my mind a little bit. But Putin graduates from Leningrad State University. I wonder if they call it LSU there. Who knows? But Putin graduates from Leningrad State University in 1975, where, of course, he studied Russian law. Today it's called St. Petersburg State University. So certainly they don't call it LSU now. But maybe they called it LSU back in 1975. Who knows? Just kind of funny thinking about Putin graduating from LSU. But anyway, studies law there in 1975. And what's very interesting is that Putin, from the very jump, was an ardent nationalist. Literally, he joins the KGB after graduating from Leningrad. And I mean, literally within months of leaving Leningrad State University, he joins the KGB. And this is very, very important because the KGB goes on to shape his entire worldview, his entire view of leadership, his entire view of the Russian state's place on the world stage, is all not even shaded, is all completely formed by his nationalism and his joining the KGB right after college. So the KGB, and I'm going to do my best here to pronounce this correctly with a very, very slight Russian accent. The KGB stands for, the English translation was the Committee for State Security. Here's what it actually means in Russian. It's very long. Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti. One more time. Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti. The Committee for State Security. The KGB has since been replaced, and this was back in the, I'm fairly certain this is essentially coincided with the fall of the Soviet Union. KGB has essentially been replaced by two main agencies, the biggest one being the Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, and the main one that replaces them domestically is the Federal Security Service, the FSB, kind of like, it's not quite an equivalent, but, you know, think about one being the CIA and the other one being the FBI. More or less. They're not exact equivalents, but that's essentially, those are the intelligence services and the security services that have replaced the KGB, at least since the early 90s. So that's, once again, the Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, and the Federal Security Service, the FSB. So Putin serves 15 years in the KGB. He's very notably serving as one of the heads of operations. I think he's second in command or possibly third in command of operations in Dresden in East Germany from approximately 1983 or 1984 to 1989. And I say approximately because, and this kind of goes for a lot of this that I'm about to kind of get into here. It is known that Putin was serving in Dresden in East Germany at approximately this time, but a lot of the exact details of time and service are mostly anecdotal, since his service records, you know, when you, I'm going to make the wild guess that anyone who serves with any kind of intelligence agency for any country, the details of their service are on a very need-to-know, a top secret, need to know basis only. So the details of a lot of this are based on kind of anecdotal evidence, stories, people that would have been there at this point in time serving with him. But there's not like there's like an official record, the same way that you would have an official military record for someone who was, you know, serving in a regular military capacity someplace else. You know, like the service records are very, very different. So just keep that in mind as we talk about this. What we do know for sure is that at his post in Dresden, he was in charge of surveillance and recruitment. You know, something two positions that you definitely give to two positions that you definitely, or I should say two things that you would put someone who is very fanatical, a zealot in charge of, right? The organizing and maintaining the surveillance arm of the KGB in Dresden, and then also obviously bringing new people into the fold, you know, be they assets, you know, just, you know, essentially criminal informants, I guess would be one way to think of it, domestic spies or other people possibly to actually like join the KGB. Those are two things that for sure would be given. Those are tasks that would 100% be given to someone who you could think of as a true believer. So we do know that Putin is in charge of surveillance and recruitment. And again, the specific activities are based on a lot of anecdotal evidence. But there are plenty of stories about how particularly brutal his tactics were, especially when it came to treatment of dissidents, people who were trying to escape into West Germany. He was especially brutal to his, you know, the treatment of other political prisoners. He was apparently quite thoroughly brutal to with his torturing techniques. And we can draw some assumptions based on this, based on the stories of other prisoners from East Germany and how other dissidents from the East German state were treated, right? Like we know that elsewhere, not necessarily in Dresden, but elsewhere in East Germany, we know that there was extensive psychological and physical torture inflicted upon people that they perceived as some kind of threat, you know, be they political dissidents, people who were just speaking ill of the Communist Party, whatever. We do know that prisoners were treated especially harsh in East Germany. We do know that you could be imprisoned for any perceived crime against the state. You could have family members be imprisoned as forms of retaliation. You know, threat, you know, people were routinely threatened with imprisonment for just, I mean, literally anything, right? And then obviously the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week of surveillance of persons of interest. Those people who kind of popped up on the map on the radar, excuse me, as people who might be perceived as a potential dissident, as a potential agitator, as those people would have been under 24/7 surveillance. But anyone within within some of these cities like Dresden would have been under extreme surveillance anyway. Any place that they went, they would have been followed. You hear these stories about. One of my favorite stories of, and it's not specific to Dresden here or East Germany, but the old Cavaliers head coach, Mike Fratello, and this is, I promise you, this will make sense. He volunteered to take a team of collegiate basketball stars over to Russia to play in a tournament, a tournament against Russia and other European basketball, basketball interested countries, like Greece, like Spain, but, you know, there was like multiple Russian teams at this tournament or whatever. But anyway, he goes over there with two different teams for two different like portions of this tournament. The details aren't important. Anyway, they were, in some of the hotels they stayed in, they only talked about basketball at all. That's all they talked about, knowing full well that they were under, that their everything in their rooms was bugged, that their mirrors were bugged, there were cameras, there was this, there were that, that people were listening to them all the time. So they only ever talked about basketball when they were in their hotel rooms. It really wasn't until they were elsewhere, out in the court or even in the locker room, they only talked about basketball. They just didn't mention anything about the United States. They didn't talk about their home lives and stuff like that. It was just all basketball because they knew that they were under surveillance 24/7. But they did find it very starkly interesting that while they were, I think this tournament was in St. Petersburg, but I can't remember exactly. But they found it interesting. They did some touristy stuff and got to see the Russian country a little bit while they were there. They did find it interesting that while they were while their hotel room was being was so heavily monitored, when you see the rest of the Russian country and how at this point in time, how ramshackle and like just far behind the rest of the Western world Russia was in a very significant sense. Just kind of like this very sad sort of, just paints this very sad sort of picture of what the Russian government really was concerning itself with at this point in time. So this all kind of, again, circles back to this surveillance, this 24/7 surveillance, this extreme surveillance being of the utmost importance to the Communist Party at this point in time. So that's what we, you know, again, drawing some assumptions here, since there isn't, it's not like we have on record in the same way that we have on record some other, you know, some other sort of military crimes and things like that. Since a lot of Putin's service was, again, more off the books and on a very need-to-know basis by only very particular people. But again, we can draw these kind of parallels based on what we do know about what was going on in East Germany at the time. So by 1990, after the fall of communism, Putin returns to Russia, and I find this pivot very interesting, fascinating even. He returns to Russia and becomes the pro-rector of Leningrad State University. Essentially, he returns to become the head of the university, and not surprisingly, in charge of recruitment and admissions is essentially what he becomes in charge of when he's back at Leningrad State. That's just such a fascinating pivot, but also maybe I'm going to read too far into this, but it kind of makes sense as well, right? That you want in this what the Russian state is becoming at this point in time, you want someone in charge of the school and who is going to the school, and you know who's in charge of who's getting into the school. Excuse me, I should say. You want someone in charge who is, again, fanatical, a zealot, and believes all the way down to, you know, the last fiber of their being that the Russian state is the most important thing. So it kind of makes sense in a way that you want someone who is going to find the people who could be indoctrinated in this very profound way to attend your universities. But I could be reading a little bit too much into this. Regardless, this is a very fascinating pivot that someone who just spent, you know, the last like 6 years or so torturing people and spying on them and recruiting assets for the KGB is now in charge of a university. But by 1994, he returns to politics. He works his way up to become the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. By 1996, he moves to Moscow to partake in federal politics. And by 1998, and this makes perfect sense, by 1998, given his background with the KGB, he is named the director of the FSB. Once again, that is the Federal Security Service, the domestic, version of the KGB he becomes the director of. In just a year later, by 1999, Putin makes the jump from domestic spying and imprisoning Russian citizens to become prime minister. And then a year later, obviously, prime minister to Boris Yeltsin. And then a year later, he becomes the handpicked successor and becomes the second president of Russia by the year 2000. And then again, obviously, to kind of, we already mentioned before, but he's president all the way through 2000 to 2008. Doesn't get reelected in 2012, or I guess maybe he can't be, I don't know. But then obviously is currently president again. So there's your background info on Vladimir's time spying on East German citizens, imprisoning them, torturing them, and then returning to Russia to spy and torture Russian citizens. And I promise you that all of that, especially, well, mostly the part about Putin and the KGB, is all very important as we talk about the Krokus City Hall terror attack. As you probably know by now, there was a terrorist attack in the heart of Moscow at a concert hall, the Krokus City Hall, wherein, at least at this particular moment, at this recording, 137 were killed and scores more were wounded and injured. I was, especially at first, seeing the original videos and everything else, I was convinced that this was, and a lot of people on the internet were convinced that this was a real life, no Russian situation. And I'll explain that very quickly here. So I believe in possibly Modern Warfare. It's a video game reference. And I believe it was from Modern Warfare 2, but or Modern Warfare 2 or Modern Warfare 3. I can't remember. It's the one wherein Russia actually invades the United States. So maybe it's Modern Warfare 3. But either way, I think it's like 2014, 2015. There was a very controversial first-person shooter mission called No Russian, where you play as this American, I want to say he was a Ranger or something, who was recruited to go undercover because he had like some kind of Russian, you know, Russian heritage that they you could actually trace to Russia. So he was a perfect sort of candidate to go undercover and infiltrate this Russian terrorist cell. And so anyway, you're playing as him in the video game. And the No Russian mission, again, it was very, very controversial. In fact, that you had options to not play it. It's not really like a battle mission. What it was you as a member of this, as the undercover member of this terrorist cell, went into a Russian airport and just began killing Russian citizens, left and right. There is some resistance from, from the airport police and the some late responding police or whatever. But basically the mission is walk up and down through this airport and kill as many people as you can. Which, and you can understand why that might have been sensitive in 2014 or 2015, whatever it was. I think 2014. Certainly that mission would not be included in a game now. But it was even controversial then. And anyway, it ends with you kind of being set up. During the whole attack, they're all speaking English using American accents. And then they actually kill you, the player, at the end of this mission. And they know that you're actually an American undercover agent. They kill you because all of these surviving people heard American English being spoken as these terrorists walked up and down and killed innocent people. And now the only person that was killed of the terrorists is now, we find out, it's an American soldier. It allows the Russian government and whoever the fictional president is in the video game, allows them to place blame squarely on the shoulders of America, thus justifying an invasion and everything else. So it felt like this was and if you're not interested in video games, I apologize, but it just very bizarre that this event sort of happened and how it definitely felt like a real life No Russian situation. In fact, the No Russian mission was based off of some other terrorist events, in particular, like the Chechen theater in the very similar situation to this, but the Chechen insurgents theater incident in which several hundred people were killed in that as well. You can go ahead and look that up if you'd like. But I was very much convinced that this was some kind of No Russian inside job situation. And this would 100% track with the general Putin playbook, which is based off of the KGB playbook and his experiences in the KGB. Unleashing violence and mayhem in your own country against your own people to frighten them into submission and then blame someone else to galvanize everyone against a common enemy or have some kind of built-in justification for more extreme actions. That's exactly what the KGB and the Putin playbook would prescribe. It would not be out of the ordinary to have, this is something that is sort of, it's a big piece of fiction. Thinking about something like V for Vendetta, where I can't remember the name of the government that takes over in that particular graphic novel. I think the Norse Fire Party, and the Norse Fire Party uses biological warfare, biological terror against its own citizens. There are numerous, like I said, I just mentioned the No Russian mission in Call of Duty. There are numerous things from pop culture, numerous ideas in pop culture about countries attacking their own citizens for very particular meaningful political purposes, right? But and while those things are fiction, they are based off of reality, and they are based off of ideas that have been they're based off of ideas that you know have been thrown around in intelligence meetings, even if they've never been acted upon. They have been thrown around. And this is why, you know, there are conspiracy theories about 9/11. There are conspiracy theories about every terrorist attack, right? Because at the very least, someone in the CIA, someone in the KGB, someone in, I can't remember what British intelligence is, MI5 or MI6 or whatever it is. I think MI6. You know that there at least have been discussions about that. In how it would benefit, or would more than likely the cost benefit analysis would probably tell the people discussing these ideas that they would not be totally beneficial. But this is something that would 100% be in a KGB playbook, and therefore is 100% in the Putin playbook. But as more facts have come to light on this, I don't think this was a proverbial inside job. So what we know now is that four terrorists have been apprehended. I think two have pled guilty at the time of this recording, and they are affiliated with ISIS. I think very, very particularly, they are ISIS-K members. It's ISIS Khorasan, I believe, is ISIS-K. So that kind of, it kind of dampens the idea that this is an inside job, especially considering that the U.S. had issued warnings. The U.S. embassy had issued warnings in Moscow that Moscow was in the crosshairs for some kind of ISIS attack. And there was an emphasis on large gatherings, which makes the most sense. Most of these terrorist attacks are against crowded areas, but they had actually mentioned very particularly concert halls. And obviously those warnings went completely unheeded by Russia. And again, they didn't find four ISIS patsies to blame this on. ISIS has long-standing grievances with Moscow. They stretch all the way back to the Soviet war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. The way that Russia really brutally engineered its counterinsurgency against Chechnya in the 1990s, and then more recently Russia's unabashed support of Bashar al-Assad's Syrian government, who is also attacking and killing its own citizens. So there are legitimate, long-standing grievances with ISIS in Russia. In fact, ISIS has recently attacked Russia. I want to say in 2022, they attacked an embassy. Again, should have written this down. ISIS has been attacking Russia for quite a long time. And if you're kind of, probably a lot of people are very unfamiliar with the geography, especially since Russia is so fucking big. It's bordered by a lot of countries. But the southern portion of Russia, southeastern portion of Russia, especially when you get down towards the Ukraine, and you get down to that southern point of Russia, you run into Azerbaijan. I just wanted to double check on that one. I apologize. But once you get into that southern portion, that very, very southern portion of Russia, where it begins to meet the Middle East, essentially. I mean, Russia is sitting right on top of the Middle East. There's a buffer there. There's Georgia. There's Azerbaijan, Armenia, and there's Iran. There's Turkey. There's Syria. There's Iraq. Russia sits right on top of the Middle East. So it really is. This does make a lot of sense. Even I don't like to really traffic in conspiracy theories, but ISIS attacking them makes perfect sense, since ISIS does view Russia as a legitimate enemy to them. So there is plenty of evidence, plus the admission of guilt by the gunmen, who were, I don't know if you saw their court appearances, they were severely injured in their court appearances in Moscow. That's not shocking. But again, this really does feel like this was ISIS acting alone on this. There was no, this wasn't Putin, paying people to do this. This wasn't Putin having scientists pushed out a window or anything like that. This was truly ISIS acting on its own will. However, I will call what did happen, and the fact that the warnings, as I had mentioned before, the warnings for this were already out there, but they went unheeded on purpose by Russia. So again, I don't want to traffic in conspiracy theories, but I don't think this is that far of a stretch at all. I don't even think this really counts as a conspiracy theory because, again, this is a part of the Putin playbook. So what was this then? If it's not an inside job, this is something called purposeful inaction. Putin knew the attack was imminent. The FSB knew the attack was imminent. The SVR knew the attack was imminent. Anyone related to security matters or intelligence matters in Russia knew that this attack was imminent. If the American embassy is blasting out loud, "Hey, people, you need to avoid crowded areas in Moscow in the coming weeks because there is going to be a terrorist attack," then you had better believe that all the important Russian agencies associated with security intelligence also knew this as well. But they purposely did nothing. There was even mention about how the Moscow police and the emergency services response was extremely, extremely slow. I don't feel like the first security officer or cop showed up, if I'm remembering correctly, until 40 or 50 minutes into what was happening. It sounds like the Uvalde Police Department was in charge of the response to this. But realistically, here's what happened. Do you think that the Moscow police and the Moscow emergency services operate independently of Putin? If you do believe that, then I have a bridge to sell you. I have some oceanfront property in Arizona to sell you. I have some invisible clothes to sell you. There is absolutely no fucking way that the Moscow police as a whole, that the Moscow fire department, that the Moscow hosp that they run independently of Putin. There is no possible way, especially when they are responding to something as large scale as a terrorist attack. They do not run independently of Putin. So the slow response, the fact that this attack happened, everything was allowed to happen. Everything that happened over the weekend was allowed to happen by Putin. So why would Putin do this? Even though, and Putin definitely knows this could be looked at as a failure of his security services. And that's definitely the narrative that you'll see in a lot of American press. Even look at like the other European press, look at the British press. You'll see that there is this kind of narrative of him, of this sort of being a general failure of the state, his failure, whatever. But he doesn't care because he is not looking at this as an outsider, right? Obviously, he's not an outsider. He is the head of Russia, but he is looking at this very, very differently. It really provides him with an opportunity for a lot of insidious things, right? As we've already seen him come out and say at this point, this is his best excuse to further paint Ukraine as the agitator in their current war against his current war, I should say, against the former republic. He's already blamed Ukraine. It is just his excuse to sort of further paint Ukraine in that light and stir up sentiment, anti-Ukrainian sentiment, essentially within his own country. He also now has a built-in excuse to enact more drastic measures in the pursuit of defeating Ukraine. He now has an excuse to completely mobilize all of Russia's military assets, including the potential use of their nuclear arsenal, be it against Ukraine or any other perceived enemy or anyone else that Russia will probably eventually name as potential co-conspirators along with Ukraine. That's a potential. I don't think that's imminent or anything like that. But regardless, this pushes a little bit more. This pushes the scale a little bit more to Putin, kind of having an excuse to do anything he wants to in terms of pursuing military victory against Ukraine. This also would lead to, if we're going to mobilize all the Russian military assets, this includes gaining more Russian military assets in the form of human capital. Do not be surprised if in the coming months there is a conscription of potentially all certain aged Russian men to the military. They've already, you know, there's already been, some of this has already happened, but don't be surprised if this is now becomes more widespread in the coming months, that that to buff this perceived threat or this new threat from Ukraine, that that, you know, the fake threat from Ukraine, don't be surprised if now we're going to see just outright conscription of Russian men to the military. And then finally, the thing that I think will happen, that will definitely happen, will be implementation of martial law. This makes it much easier to crack down on people like the late Alexei Navalny and other dissidents. You know, people who are protesting, people who are doing this. You declare martial law in your country and you can kind of do anything you want to. Well, not kind of. You can do anything you want to the citizens of your country. And short of intervention from some other country, which will never happen, the instant that someone tries to intervene on Russian soil, get ready for World War III. Maybe could be the last world war, if that actually happens. So the implementation of martial law will kind of be one of the last steps that Putin takes on his journey towards trying to defeat Ukraine and also trying to defeat the dissidents and the protesters and the people who are anti-Putin and anti-Russian invasion. The implementation of martial law will help take care of all of them. So as I mentioned before, despite what it looks like from the outside, Putin only cares about the perception inside Russia, right? And what it means for his ability to maneuver politically and also maneuver as military strategy against Ukraine, and how to position himself against the West. It's all he cares about. He does not care about what the outside perception is. And if you don't think that he would purposely let a terrorist attack unfold in the heart of Russia, you are vastly underestimating how much his KGB background informs his approach to leadership and informs his approach to, I shouldn't say approach, but informs his worldview of Russia's place on the big stage, in the world stage, and what the West, how the West is the biggest antagonist of Russian supremacy. You are vastly underestimating exactly what this guy spent a lifetime learning. You are vastly underestimating exactly how ardently, deeply he cares about Russian victory, right? This is Russian victory at any and all costs. This is defeating the West, defeating the U.S. at any and all costs. And this includes the cost of over 100 of your own citizens' lives. Truly, there is no bottom for Putin to hit, which is what makes him so fucking dangerous. There is no bottom for him. Obviously, we're never going to know the full extent of the truth, simply because this the terrorist attack happened on Russian soil. So, you know, we're going to know enough to make some assumptions, more better than assumptions, to make educated guesses on exactly the whole truth of the matter. But because it happened in Russia, we're never going to get the full truth. And sort of as a general rule, whatever Putin says, whatever comes out of Russian state media, probably shouldn't believe anyway. I mean, this goes back to the days of the Soviet Union. One of my favorite stories about this is from the 1980s, where whenever there was a piece on Russian state TV about something great, you know, something that the government did, one of the leaders of the Communist Party did, they're kind of glorifying something. If someone in Russia, you know, they would see this, if they had friends or family members in another country, they would call them and ask them if something happened in Russia that day. You know, like they would just call up and ask, like, did something terrible happen? So, like, one of the best examples of this is when the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, went critical and imploded in Pripyat, in Ukraine, what is now Ukraine. People across Russia were kind of given these interesting updates about some of the positive things that were going on with the Russian nuclear, not nuclear system, their nuclear program. and some other things that that were positive that were happening with the Russian government and Russian scientists. And immediately people were calling to the United States, to people in Germany, people in England, like, hey, did something terrible happen in Russia today? Because all we're seeing on state media is like great stuff, like stuff glorifying Russia. And yes, they had to find out from outside of Russian media, from outside of the country, that in fact the Chernobyl power plant went up. Obviously, it didn't like explode or anything. Like, well, it did explode, but it went critical. The reactor fractured, and thousands upon thousands of people within the first few days died. And obviously, it just got worse from there. The potential death toll, the estimated death toll from Chernobyl. Some estimates have it like at over 300,000 deaths because of the exposure to radiation. Russia says it's more like 3,000, which is, again, if Russia says that, they're probably lying. But anyway, it's kind of getting off track here. But this is, don't believe anything Russia says, basically, which is, going to kind of obscure the whole truth of the matter. But I feel like we already know enough to make some assumptions about things. And we know enough about Putin, his background, to make some further assumptions about things. So I don't think, again, I don't want to beat this horse, but it is not exactly a wild stretch to imagine someone with no moral compass, who doesn't really see the difference between truth and lies, who only is a consequentialist, and that is only a consequentialist, and the only outcome that he cares about is Russian victory, would not be terribly surprising if he let a terrorist attack unfold in his own country. But that's it for today. We are done with our Russian history lesson and our main kind of topic, the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack, and whether or not Putin let it happen, probably. But that's it for today. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for listening. We will be back tomorrow. As we talk about, what are we talking about tomorrow? I probably should get a look at this list here real quick before I go on with it. As we talk about privacy tomorrow. So we'll see you then.